what I think attracted people to indie media wasn't the tech. It wasn't this fetishization of the open publishing, even though that was cool. It was about telling stories that weren't getting told otherwise. Do all of our photos from protests need to be archived on Facebook? Do all of our communications and events and calendars need to, you know, only be shared on Facebook? Does all of our networking need to occur, you know, in this pavilion that we know is not always working and, in fact, regularly working in very unethical ways? I mean, the internet is whatever we build it to be, you know, and I still firmly believe that, and I still hope that that's the case. And so, you know, must we always succumb to just what's given to us, or can we build something better, something that's not damaging, something that doesn't, you know, require surveillance to operate, that it doesn't profile us, something that isn't reinforcing stereotypes or monetizing our attention and producing boredom and then exploiting that boredom? Like, you know, these things are all very unhealthy. And what if we could create a networked world that was at least a little bit more in our interest, or a moment of respite from these corporatized places?
Welcome to Radio Survivor. We're here for the love of radio and sound. My name is Paul Reese-Mandel.
My name is Eric Klein, and today on Radio Survivor, we are here for the love of indie media. The whole thing. Low-power FM radio, media consolidation activism, and as well as the mysterious and elusive indie media movement, which we're going to be talking about today with our guest, April Glazer, who writes about technology at Slate Magazine. We're joined on the line by April Glazer, journalist at Slate covering technology and author of the article Another Network is Possible, which is published in the August edition of Logic Magazine. April, thanks for joining us today on Radio Survivor.
Thanks for having me.
April, you wrote about indie media in the article Another Network is Possible. Why did you want to write this article?
Well, first of all, it's the 20th anniversary of indie media, and also because indie media is, or was, I mean, it still exists, but it's just an example of this incredible way that the web can be organized and the way that platforms can be built by and for the people that use them, that's outside of the kind of corporatized internet that we're all kind of like trapped in we're all kind of trapped in today. And by that, I mean the platforms, the walled gardens like Facebook and Google and Twitter, these companies that kind of lasso most of our attention and our activity online. You know, in the late 90s and early aughts, people were building their own platforms and one that had a particular, you know, political agenda. And I thought it was a history worth unpacking as we think about what the future could look like.
And for folks who are never exposed to indie media, for maybe, you know, heard the name thrown around but never had an opportunity to really see any of it in action, can you briefly encapsulate, when you say indie media, what specifically are you talking about? It's A-I-N-D-Y-M-E-D-I-A. And, you know, I think sometimes it gets conflated with people will say independent media, which is indie, I-N-D-I-E.
Yeah, or media. Indie rock, which is right. Just a genre.
Exactly. Can you help us, for folks who were never exposed, can you tell us a little bit more about the specific movement you're talking about?
Sure. So indie media is actually a shorthand for independent media center, or it's often just called the indie media movement. And it was a network of websites that were all kind of based locally somewhere. So there was like a Nashville or Tennessee indie media, which is the one that I helped work on early on. There was one in Washington, D.C., in Philadelphia. They were all over the world. There's, you know, Argentina, throughout Mexico, Canada, throughout Europe, you know, there were hubs in Africa and throughout South America. And they were kind of local news websites and blogs where people could write a post about what was going on locally or comment about something that was happening internationally and kind of be a grassroots journalist. But this local reporting, these local news hubs, were all linked together in the indie media network. They all kind of you know, circled back or linked back to the mothership website. I think it was indiemedia.net or .org. I don't remember what the ending was. But through that, it was kind of a feed of grassroots political reporting from around the world. And the idea of creating this was that the mainstream media was not covering movements very well and really not getting voices from the grassroots, not collecting voices of those who were, you know, perhaps most in danger by whatever political situation was being reported on. and giving a way to elevate those voices because there was a lack of faith that television news, that, you know, consolidatedly owned newspapers, just corporate media was not really reporting in a way that really reflected the needs of the communities that were being harmed. And so this network of independent journalists really tried to provide a voice for that. And this was at a time before a lot of people were using the internet for this type of work. So it really did feel like an alternative news website, yeah. A grassroots news website.
Yeah, as you mentioned in your article, and we're at the 20-year anniversary of indie media starting, it tended to, local indie media centers tended to pop up around large political events like the Republican National Convention, or in Miami, there was the Free Trade of the Americas, I think, organization meeting in Seattle. Of course, the 20th anniversary is because in Seattle, there was a large organizing effort surrounding the WTO meeting, the World Trade Organization meeting that was going to be happening in Seattle in 1999. And these big events, these big political events that were being, that there was an organizing effort on the left to oppose these events, that was sort of a lot of the energy behind the founding of these indie media centers. But then they would go on, they would live on beyond these street battle moments.
Exactly. So they would pop up often to cover a protest because there was a knowledge that protests were not covered, giving voice to those who were protesting as well, and usually would skew towards those who already had some sort of institutionalized power, and those were the people who were often being protested against. And so protesters kind of started their own website to make sure that their story got told, and that's kind of how Indie Media got started. Indie Media, the first website, formed in 1999 during the World Trade Organization ministerial conference in Seattle, Washington. And the idea was that, thousands and thousands of people were descending on Seattle to protest the WTO meeting because it was seen as a force that would allow for corporations to supersede national laws,
environmental laws and labor laws.
Absolutely. Yeah. And there was labor organizers were there, farm workers were showing up, activists were showing up, and were really very concerned about, increasing globalized capitalism, right? And just that these multinational corporations were going to further entrench their power and act further in their interest and less in the interest of the public or the people that live near them or that are hurt by the production of their products, particularly looking for lower wages around the world with less labor protections and environmental protections, as you mentioned. And so they created a storefront or like a kind of an indie media center is what it was called, with computers and cameras and people coming in and out, documenting police violence, documenting the protests, documenting minute by minute coverage of, these days long violent protests that weren't getting the same extensive coverage on television. I mean, of course, they were being covered in newspapers and on television, but not from the perspective of those who were protesting, who had grievances that they were trying to air on the streets. And so a lot of the indie media centers popped up around the anti-globalization movement that was very much one of the most important issues on the left at the time. Yeah. So yes, in Miami around the Free Trade Area of America's meeting, an indie media started in 2003, but then also around larger political convergences, like you mentioned, in Philadelphia with the Republican National Convention in 2000.
And what we have to underline, even though it almost feels a little bit silly, this is 20 years ago, prior to Facebook and Twitter and YouTube and phones, no one had a computer in their hand that could stream to the internet. And so this was really the first time that the internet was being used to tell these individual stories by community journalists.
Yeah, one thing that's really incredible about indie media, there are a lot of incredible things, not the least of which being we're talking about a whole network and a platform that was built by and for the people that were using it. But the fact that it was usable.
A nonprofit. It was, there's no, There was no corporate seed money. There
and
was
often
no
not even
business plan.
Institutionalized or corporatized in any sort of way.
Yeah.
In fact, it was anti-capitalist. Yes. So I'm sure more money was lost than made with Indie Media. I'm positive of that. But and people really invested themselves in this because they were driven by a political motivation to make sure that stories were being told and that, you know, resistance movements could continue to form with the information that they needed to protest, knowing what's going on in the world politically. But one thing that Indie Media pioneered, one of the things that it kind of not necessarily invented, but created the first most usable version of, is open publishing. And so one of the things about Indie Media that was really liberatory and really exciting is that anybody could be a journalist, anybody could publish. And the open publishing software that was built for the Indie Media website, it was launched with the Seattle protest. That code base was then riffed on. It was open source free software, and then replicated in every Indie Media center that was formed thereafter, of which I think there were around 150 or more, where anybody could post to the news feed. And it was probably, this was before WordPress, right? This was before we had really accessible blogging, and it was before we had all had handheld phones. So people would film with a camera, go back to their computer, and upload it to the website so it could be shared globally.
And I think even that multimedia aspect is really important, because from the very beginning, it enabled text, audio, video, and pictures. That was, baked in from the very beginning. And in 1999, successfully distributing your audio or video online, if you did not have capital.
Yeah, even your photos. Even your photos in 1999. It was not, there was not like a given way to share that stuff.
You would have to ask a corporation to host it for you, and then you could perhaps share the link like with Photo Bucket or something like that. But I don't even think that was around in 1999.
Yeah. And I think also when you say open publishing, you mean you uploaded it to the Indie Media site, whichever one you uploaded it to. It was published immediately, right? There were no, from my recollection, I was involved in the movement at that time. There was no editor. There was nobody reviewing things. It went immediately up on the web.
Well, so this actually brings up an important aspect of Indie Media is the localism. So every instance of Indie Media, every Indie Media center that was set up, whether it was in, Cincinnati, I don't know if there was one there, but like one in Ohio or one in Florida, in Miami, had local rules that governed the site. Each one was autonomous. And so some did have a screening process or an editor that would choose the stories that went to the top of the feed, someone that would, pull out stories that were spam or that were full of hateful content,
right,
making sure that that the site wasn't used for abuse. So there was always some level of moderation. But yes, anybody could post and it would be live, and then there was a chance it could be ferreted out later by an editorial process. But those processes were all autonomous and were rules that were created by the local entity that was hosting it.
And they would get aggregated up to the main indiemedia.org site, so that something that was published in London or was published in Barcelona could show up alongside something that came from New York or elsewhere. During that time, I was active in the Indie Media site that went up in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, which is a sort of off-the-grid place by comparison. I think it seems like it's the home of the University of Illinois, but has a very long tradition of community media, independent media, and activist organizing, as many college towns in the Midwest do, places like Madison, Wisconsin, also Kona Minor, Ann Arbor, Michigan. And I actually remember for a time I was part of the collective that would occasionally have to edit the site. When people talk about trolling now, right, whether it's on Twitter or on Facebook or elsewhere, I remember having to deal with it, back then, 15 years ago, where we had persistent people posting, hateful content, menacing content, and trying to figure out, as we would weigh out as a collective, and we did work as a collective, what should or should not stay. But then also figuring out, because it seems like their screen names and where they came from would change by the minute, right? It's like a problem that hasn't gone away. And I think every local collective kind of had to work through.
Yeah, and the localism, I think, allowed the collectives to figure out how to fix it. And one thing that's really an interesting corollary now, a conversation we're having now and something that I report on as like a national reporter on the technology industry, is that companies like Facebook and YouTube have had a very, very difficult time weeding out the hateful content that that is possible on any site that allows for open publishing, like Facebook and YouTube does. And you know, these have been issues since the very, very beginning of this format of you know, interaction online. But when your hub is local, when it's smaller, when it's not the World Wide Web. I mean, of course, this was the World Wide Web, but you know, it's a small collective is running it. There was more of a level of accountability, and also software engineers who volunteered their time built, you know, tools that allowed for like spam filtering tools, or mm-hmm. that would look for words that were abusive or hateful and flag the post before it was published for review. And so, people have been thinking about these issues that, you know, the large technology companies can't seem to figure out how to fix for a very long time, and have even built solutions very early on, given not at the scale that we're talking about now. But these were questions that were happening from the very beginning of indie media. And it's interesting to watch these companies kind of flounder about how to deal with this now, because perhaps they weren't thinking about it from the beginning of their platform, because they didn't have the same, you know, ethical or principled reason for forming it, and therefore, you know, are having to go back now and deal with the racism that is so embedded in these networks.
You know, and it's, I think it's very important that you bring up that local basis, because my recollection from my time at the Urbana-Champaign IMC is that if we ever had somebody who was posting, you know, hateful content or very attacking content, and they objected strenuously to being moderated, we invited them to come to our meetings. Mm-hmm. Right. We had actual meetings. Well, we actually had a rented space that eventually became a purchase space in Urbana, Illinois. We felt like, well, we could talk this out. So please come and explain to us why this content should be on our site, you know, the community site, why that should be propagated, as opposed to like it's a nameless censor, you know, who is simply taking things out. We tried to personalize it, and that was part of making it as an editorial collective, which meant there was no one person who had control. We were all coming to some sort of agreement.
A lot of hard work, a lot of unpaid volunteer labor to create a halfway decent community, but still possibly preferable to how it's done these days.
Yeah, and it's like this with any, you know, activist movement, you know, whether it's, you know, cop watch initiatives here in the Bay Area, it's always a lot of unpaid labor. And this was certainly an activist project. I think that's something to really keep in mind with indie media, too, is that like these were volunteers and people were doing this because it was tactical. There was a purpose for this. You know, yes, it was journalism. Like, yes, it was reporting. Yes, it was investigations. You know, indie medias would put FOIA requests in. They would try to get documents. They would try to publish things. Houston Indie Media, for example, got FOIA requests from the police there. And when I say FOIA, Freedom of Information Act requests, public records requests. But they were doing this within a political agenda, which was grounded in, you know, community accountability and, you know, anti-capitalist values, anti corporate values, anti-racist values that were very, very explicit.
That's the voice of April Glazer, journalist at Slate covering technology. We're on the line because we're talking about April's article, Another Network is Possible, that was published in Logic Magazine, celebrating indie media, talking about indie media and how we're here at the 20-year anniversary of the founding of the first Indie Media Center. It was a movement of an independent platform, a non-corporate internet where people could share the news prior to the Facebooks and the Twitters and the YouTubes that we're currently all submerged in.
And April, you yourself were involved in the movement, correct?
I was. And I want to get back to the political aspect of that. Sure. And why I got involved. Because, you know, as a journalist now, there's this idea of this kind of imaginary idea of pure journalism, right? And indie media.
Yeah, the view from nowhere.
Yeah, the view from nowhere. And the indie media said, no, no, no. There are people who are being oppressed, and we want to make sure that their stories get told because, you know, the CNNs and the NBCs, the ABCs of the world aren't handing the mic to them, you know? And so we want to be sure that these voices are going to have a platform as well. And that was why I got involved. I wasn't involved because I was like, you know, enchanted by the technology of it, although I thought it was cool and it was exciting and, like, you know, hackers are cool. But I wasn't a hacker. I'm not a programmer. I was a local activist and a wannabe reporter, and had a you know, voice recorder and would go ask people questions at the state capitol and then go back and write a post.
This was the state capital of Tennessee?
Yeah, in Nashville. Or in the Capitol building. We were working because we were worried about what was going on, whether it was, you know, homophobic bills that were making their way through the legislature, policing that was being increased in public schools, mountaintop removal mining as a way of, you know, getting coal out of East Tennessee, Appalachia, that was decimating, you know, the environment there and has been a huge issue in terms of pollution. You know, we were reporting about our community, and because we were concerned about what was happening, and these stories weren't being covered. And so, you know, what I think attracted people to indie media wasn't the tech. It wasn't this fetishization of the open publishing, even though that was cool. Yeah. It was about, you know, telling stories that weren't getting told otherwise.
Yeah, but yeah. In a way, when we're talking today on Radio Survivor about, you know, we are fetishizing the platform a little bit because I think it's just very useful here 20 years later. I mean, for one thing, it might be time to sort of reveal that when indie media is turning 20 years old and it's not the same website and it's not the same organization that it used to be. There's still a few indie media centers that still exist and are still being used. I think, if I'm not mistaken, it's much more of like a Central American, like South American. That's where the actual like reporting work is still happening. But for the most part, it's a story with a beginning, a middle, and an ending in a way. Here in 2020, in the year 2019, 2020, indie media has sort of we can sort of write the book. We can close the book on its existence. And so looking backwards at this independent platform and seeing it and comparing it to our current, you know, dominant platforms that are owned by Facebook or Twitter for the most part. It's an interesting way to think about it because, you know, we know that the feeds are not fair.
Right. And so, like, before I was a journalist for about a decade, I worked on as an activist at nonprofits and you know, on political campaigns. And I'm very open about this because I have to be as a journalist. So I know it's not the typical route for people that go into journalism because you're supposed to be, you know, neutral or what have you. But it's actually given me a lot of sourcing and it's been a fantastic career change. I've really enjoyed it. But I do know, and anyone who does movement work today will tell you about the centrality of these social networks to every campaign that you launch, you know, and there's no choice but to use these platforms that are perhaps not working in your interest or perhaps working against your interest. But you have to use them because this is how word gets out. This is how you network. And you try to use them strategically and instrumentalize them and make something go viral. But, you know, because of the massive nature of these platforms, you know, you might have an action that goes viral or a campaign that goes viral, but then the next day something else will catch people's attention. And they're not really good for the type of, like, sustained movement work often that a campaign needs. And often they're, like, you know, working against you algorithmically, or they're, you know, selling targeted ads that are harmful to the communities that you're trying to help. You know, like, you know, it was only last year that Facebook was barred from allowing housing ads to be targeted to people, you know, based on racial identifiers, right? Because it was considered discriminatory. And so if you're working on housing justice and you're using Facebook to get your movement out there, you know that these platforms aren't necessarily working in your interest. And so I'm really interested in what if there was a place where we could do the organizing, and, you know, you can never untether from these platforms, but what if there was a separate place that, you know, wasn't, if you weren't constantly beating against the tide, or, you know, what if there was another place to go to share that was a moment of respite from these platforms that are monetizing against us.
I wonder, this might be way out of left field, but I almost wonder if one of the reasons why 20 years ago indie media was useful and why in 2019 I feel like just running down the Facebooks and the Twitters is that it was a laptop and desktop publishing platform that we got our information by sitting down and having more of an experience of, a temporary experience of getting some information while sitting at a desk and then getting up from the desk and moving on. And we live in a world now of this, the permanent screen in our hand that might just be better suited for snacking on media.
Yeah, I mean, indie media was a creature of its era, there's no doubt. But if another project was to launch today that, was operated by people and movements that, other movements could trust, it would look very different than indie media did. We use all kinds of platforms that are not corporatized. So I rely on Signal, which is an encrypted, messaging app on the phone across Android and iPhone. To do so much of my reporting. I mean, every day I'm always on Signal all the time. Mm-hmm. That's an outpost that's outside of kind of, the corporate, platforms for communicating. Yeah. And so even just a place to like do all of our photos from protests need to be archived on Facebook. Should they be archived somewhere else first that can be shared? And of course, shared on Facebook too. Do all of our communications and events and calendars need to, only be shared on Facebook? Does all of our networking need to occur, in this pavilion that we know is not always working and in fact regularly working in very unethical ways? And so there's a question about what if another internet? I mean, the internet is whatever we build it to be. Yeah. And I still firmly believe that, and I still hope that that's the case. And so, must we always succumb to just what's given to us, or can we build something better, something that's not damaging, something that doesn't, require surveillance to operate, that it doesn't profile us because, the only way to make use of all this data is to profile it, something that isn't reinforcing stereotypes or monetizing our attention and producing boredom and then exploiting that boredom. Like, these things are all very unhealthy. And what if we could create a networked world that was at least a little bit more in our interest or a moment of respite from these corporatized places? And I think that it would be useful also because, as a radio show, as community radio enthusiasts, that these platforms, like when I started the radio station with a group of people in Nashville, it was a nexus for our community as the community defined itself, right? And so all of these groups came together with the radio station that would have never probably worked together otherwise, or if they would, it would have taken a lot of work to bring us together and find our shared issues. But, because we shared the radio station, the Cambodian community, the Somali community, the environmentalists, the, interfaith leaders, the homeless advocates, we all were using the same radio station. Because of that, we were able to do so much solidarity work. And really, we shared infrastructure, we shared tools. And it really strengthens movements when you have common ground like that.
April Glazer, I mean, I think you bring up a great point about this non-determination. Like, the internet is not determined yet, right? And in fact, as you point out, it's a point we say about radio all the time. Just because commercial radio and the radio system ended up the way it did doesn't mean that it was somehow divinely predicted that way.
The end result of some kind of social Darwinism or right. Darwinist capitalism. Like, we don't have the best possible radio landscape or best possible media landscape.
Exactly. And that, this is true for the internet as it is for radio. And, you mentioned your work with a low power station there. That again was in Nashville, correct?
Yes, it was in Nashville, Tennessee. Radio Free Nashville.
Radio Free Nashville. And did that go? I'm going to take us in a little bit of a radio direction now.
Let's do it.
Did that go on the air in the in that first wave of low power FM stations in the early part of the 2000s?
Yeah, that's when the license was received, and it went on air in 2005 with the barn raising with Prometheus Radio Project, which is a nonprofit that I eventually ended up working at in Philadelphia, where I moved from Nashville to work with them. But yeah, we got our construction permit with that first wave.
And was there a connection at all between the Indie Media Center that existed there in Nashville and the LPFM? Either, if not formally, sort of informally, because of the folks who might have been involved.
April Glazer was definitely one node in that connection.
Well, I'm one here, and absolutely, it was a completely interconnected. We were media activists in a relatively small city, and so there was briefly an indie media show, but that kind of dissipated into people having their own individual shows. But everybody, you know, was deeply involved in both projects and saw this both as very much interconnected as, you know, our attempt to have accountable local grassroots journalism that was coming from the communities that it was serving.
And was there a community radio station in Nashville before that?
Over in the history of Nashville, yes. But at the time, no, there was a college radio station, WRVU, which has since been very much narrowed, but it was the Vanderbilt College radio station.
Yes, and our colleague Jennifer Waits has written extensively about that. We'll put it in our show notes at radiosurvivor.com. But, you know, and that was one of those stations that was a college station formally, but certainly a community station in practice. We've talked about several others over the years.
It was great, yeah. I had a show with friends on and off there, too. So it was a community that's, like, you know, it was kind of the buckle of the Bible Belt in many ways, but also has this amazing civil rights history, this radical organizing history, and really no place for us to be telling the stories of the activism that was very much present in the community. And so we wanted a place to do that, and radio made sense because at the time in 2005, not everybody was online. In fact, you know, internet adoption rates were quite low at that point. And so this was the most accessible way. It probably reached more people in many ways than the indie media site did. But both were acting very much in concert, and the people were involved in both projects.
And I know of at least two other low-power FM stations that have pretty formal affiliations with independent media centers. One is WOOC-LP in Troy, New York, where there was the Media Sanctuary, which still exists. It sort of started as an independent media center and persisted in its goals and its instantiation as a local physical place for people to come together around issues of justice.
Nothing like having a building to go with your website.
Yeah.
It's so important.
And they did exist in some places. Yeah. Not every independent media center had a physical instantiation, but many did. Many were sort of virtual-ish.
Yeah, I think the physical, DC had a physical center, which I visited many times around like inauguration, covering inauguration events. There was a physical space in Houston. Having this place where people could go and meet, again, as I mentioned, the radio station that kind of acts as a nexus for the community. Indie media centers did as well. You know, people would come and use the space to hold meetings, to produce documentaries, to use the internet, to upload audio that would be shared, with all kinds of radio stations. They were meeting places. And so the media making wasn't this thing that was, we're all just posting from our individual podiums, from our accounts on Facebook or Twitter and firing off some missive that might go viral or might not get seen by anybody. But rather the media making was there was a togetherness to it.
It was
intentional, and then it was put out in the world.
It reminds me of a tweet that I'll have to hunt down and give good attribution on the website, radiosurvivor.com. But there was a tweet from a couple months ago that I think ended up getting retweeted by AOC, and that then it went super viral. But that the idea that libraries could be open in the evenings so that people could form communities in a physical space outside of the restaurant and bar and private homes in the world. And that idea that our communities, our local communities, deserve another way to get to work together, to meet people, especially in the evenings after work. It sounds like independent media centers, at least when they existed, as well as these radio stations, they provide that a little bit. And it's a missing piece of the of our civilization here in the United States.
Yeah, I mean, I use this verb, this word construction previously, but the centrality of technology to every movement for social justice and political change means that everybody has a need for a website or some sort of media presence. And so the idea of a media center being that central place that, you know, all other nonprofits or movements can maybe like share and co-use actually makes really good sense. And it's a fantastic tool for building solidarity locally across issue areas that that few other kind of technologies would allow for. Whether it's that, you know, it's just a website in a physical space or a radio station and a website in a physical space, whatever however that manifests, or just a radio station. This is what community media does.
Paul, I think I interrupted you. You were listing off low power FM stations that originated in indie media centers.
Yeah, and the second is the one I sort of talked about a little bit beforehand, very briefly, is WRFU LP, which is in that first wave again, went on the air in about 2004-2005 at Urbana-Champaign's Independent Media Center.
There you go. So now we know of three, and if you out there in the listening audience know of a fourth, fifth, or sixth, please do reach out to us, podcast@radiosurvivor.com. We're talking about indie media here we are accidentally at the 20-year anniversary of indie media. So we're talking about
and just about to be the 20th anniversary of Low Power FM, which those stations started going on the air in the year 2000, started being licensed, at least licenses started going out in the year 2000, which will be the 20th anniversary in January.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, you were listening to Radio Survivor. My name is Eric Klein. With me is Paul Riesmandel, and we're on the line with journalist April Glazer, who covers technology at Slate Magazine, and we're talking about indie media. April Glazer wrote an article, Another Network is Possible, that was published in Logic Magazine over the summer, and April, you were about to talk.
Yeah, so another way to kind of thread the needle between the community or independent radio movement and indie media is what happened after Katrina. And this was something that I wrote about in the article. In 2005, after the hurricane and, you know, thousands of people were displaced, many went to Texas, to Houston, to sleep in the Astrodome. It was a massive amount of chaos. People had a very difficult time finding their families, finding the help they needed, the FEMA forms, you know, knowing where to go to get medical care. And there was a real information deficit there. And the activists in Houston who were involved with the Indie Media Center noticed this information deficit right away. And they immediately applied with Prometheus Radio Project for a series of licenses, emergency licenses, to operate low-power FM stations outside of the Astrodome to provide immediate information to those in the Astrodome. And they actually distributed radios inside the facility and then started broadcasting. And they had some difficulty getting on because FEMA was giving them a hard time. But once they got on, they were immediately able to get people on the radio and connect families right away and provide much-needed material support, information, infrastructure that was lacking there. And they did it in this like very fast on the ground way that like a corporation doesn't really have an incentive to do, but these activists were doing it because it was the right thing to do. And it was the skill set that they had and they knew they could do it.
You know, it's a fascinating example because there are very few examples of any of such a sort of emergency license of any sort being handed out for radio.
It really is like it deserves its own hour-long documentary.
Absolutely.
It's the story that that I've heard repeated often, but I've never heard what that radio sounds like. I don't know if that's appropriate.
It might have been on the Houston IMC website, though.
Yeah, that's true. April Glazer, did you work for Prometheus during that moment?
No, I was ended up coming soon after, but my friends did. I was working at that time at Radio Free Nashville, but was very aware of what was going on because this was very much at the time, and you all know this, and maybe some of your listeners do too. But it was a national community of people that were media activists and were really clued in and trying to provide support across the country.
And I think you're threading the needle via this example of the emergency low power FMs that went on the air around the Astrodome to help support people who were taking shelter from Katrina. I think it's trenchant because even if folks were not involved in indie media explicitly, it is my perception and my experience of that time that it helped to kind of galvanize media activists from around the world and help to firm up a network that had existed, I think, loosely. People generally knew each other if they were working in similar areas from public access television or documentary work or radio work. But having now a digital network and a semi-formalized kind of interaction between disparate communities around the world built those networks even more strongly. It seemed to me it was easier to get to know. If you wanted to find somebody who could get a transmitter out to Houston, out to the Astrodome, it was easier there in 2005, in part because of this informal network that had built up around indie media. Would you say that's an accurate characterization?
That there was just like it was easy to connect with people.
Yeah, that it sort of helped to firm up a sort of global network of media activists and you know, around social justice issues, kind of in general, even if folks weren't always explicitly working in indie media.
Yeah, and it really positioned media as a site in and of itself of political change and engagement. And so people began to identify as media activists, right? So maybe... Yeah. You know, they worked on a lot of other issues, but they were media activists, and because media itself was a political problem, and there was a network of support around that. You know, whether it was the sharing of transmitters or transmitter kits or expertise, you know, people flying out around the country to help build stations. But there was a sense that this was a very dire need across movements that we needed to get this right in order to help everyone else.
You know, and round about the same time, at least in the U.S. context, in the political scheme, is also a more formal movement around media reform that went up as well. We had the formation of the organization Free Press.
Yes.
Around about 2003 with the first National Conference for Media Reform, which happened in Madison, Wisconsin that year. And then there were subsequent conferences in places like St. Louis and Memphis, Tennessee, all around these mid-aughts, where it was both a bit more official, if you will, in that there were congressional representatives and other people coming from government and more established nonprofits and more established sort of lobbying groups, as well as a fairly radical fringe of folks coming in from indie media. Explicitly, low power FM explicitly, and other sorts of grassroots organizing. And sometimes there was a little bit of even conflict there. But I think it's important to have this background that this idea that our media system could be different, this idea that our media system isn't serving people well, was gaining much more, I think, in the popular consciousness, is coming much more to the foreground as well. And I don't know if, April, if you participated at all in sort of that more formalized official kind of media reform movement at that time.
I did quite a bit. I actually, you know, I was young. I was like 18 when I first testified to the FCC on this. I was doing a lot of this when I was a teenager. I left high school early. And I worked on the hearings around media ownership that were happening at the FCC. And of course, but for those who don't know, Prometheus Radio Project, the nonprofit that really helped to build and substantiate the low-power FM movement at that time, had sued the FCC for consolidating or for allowing greater consolidation.
And it's still in court today. And it's still in court today.
yes. And so that's an ongoing case. There's now a second version of it. But regardless, there was a movement at the time to make sure that local media did have ownership limits, that one company couldn't own, you know, 4 radio stations, 2 television stations, and a newspaper in a single market. And, you know, this is kind of a criticism or a critique of power that I think is not as prominent in leftist circles today. The idea that consolidated media ownership is bad. I think people kind of gave up on it because the consolidation has been somewhat runaway. You know, there still are laws and limits. And in fact, there was a ruling from the federal court against FCC Chairman Pai's attempt to further consolidate radio, television, and newspaper ownership. Since doing so, the court ruled would lead to less diverse ownership by women and people of color. But at the time, there was a huge movement to stop lifting ownership limits. And this came out of the 1996 Telecommunications Act, which allowed for greater consolidation of ownership of radio across the country. Clear Channel went from owning a handful of radio stations to about 1,200 radio stations in, I think, less than 2 years. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there was a very much an understanding and a criticism of media as a political issue.
That's the voice of April Glazer, journalist at Slate covering technology. And we're talking about media ownership at this stage because we're making the case that an indie media movement that started in 1999, which helped lead to part of a media justice movement to create low power FM radio, more community radio in the margins of mostly cities, but also everywhere across the United States, building more radio stations so more people could broadcast their ideas. I mean, community radio, and then
and creating that critique that would kind of pave the way for people to get involved in that movement. I think really solidifying this as a something that people would want to engage in, and kind of creating that framing as a problem.
Yeah, and leading to the media ownership and consolidation. I actually just wanted to rewind a little bit and say that when that legendary story now of the Katrina refugees in Houston being served by having a emergency low power FM radio station there at the Astrodome, and the distribution of little cheap FM radios so that they could all receive information. For me in 2005, if that's when that took place, I was working at a radio station at that time, and it still took that story to sort of open my eyes, open my ears to the idea that radio wasn't becoming obsolete. That it still really had a purpose in our civilization, a communication purpose that we didn't need to sort of run beyond. That there was a reason to still focus on radio and how it serves communities, how it serves people.
There were a few instances around the country at that time that really made it clear that radio and having locally community run. Broadcasting outposts were incredibly important for community safety. One was, for example, in LPFM in Jupiter, Florida, that was providing up-to-the-minute updates on where that hurricane was moving and where people could go to find shelter and safety needs that the closest, corporate radio station serving that community was very far away, miles and miles away, and was not giving that local coverage that is really life-saving. Just having something that's accountable locally and that can tell those stories and give that on-the-ground reporting in places that are perhaps, consolidated into large markets otherwise by corporate media. And the Houston example is also a great showing of these internet media activists weren't, it wasn't just about the internet. It was about the media. It was about serving the information needs of the community.
Yeah.
April Glazer, today you are a professional journalist.
And yes.
That's not an accusation.
No, I know. It's just funny. I am a professional journalist.
And so I wonder, in what way is your work today informed by this experience, having come up through, independent media like this?
Sure. And, there are a lot of fantastic journalists who came out of the indie media movement. Shane Bauer, for example, who's at Mother Jones, award-winning journalist, used to write for Indie Bay here in the San Francisco Bay Area. I'm in Oakland. And so it is absolutely informed my work in terms of understanding the voices from the communities that are being harmed, that grassroots voices, need to be put front and center as much as possible, and that's a narrative that can be the driving narrative of a story. And also having a kind of embedded critique of corporate power and of, the agendas of the corporations that I'm writing about are not going to be aligning with the people who are using the tools that they're putting out there. And so as I report on platforms like Facebook or YouTube, I have a very deep understanding, an experiential understanding of how, we often use media tools or we depend on media companies despite the fact that they're not necessarily serving our interest. And it's definitely been a locus of my reporting.
And you're allowed to follow through with that as someone who reports for, you know, what is effectively a corporate outlet, if not something on the size of a New York Times or an NBC.
Yes, I can't hide my past. And the fact that I used to, you know, do political organizing or work at nonprofits doesn't change the fact that all of my stories are deeply sourced and reported and, you know, fact checked and absolutely, you know, getting the story right is the most important thing. But it affects where I look for stories, you know, and it affects who I talk to. And also the conclusions that I'm drawing, from these stories. One of the things I really like about Slate and The Intercept is like this too, these are publications that allow for people to do investigative work, but also allow for us to write columns or to draw lessons out of our investigations and hopefully bring readers to a place that they weren't at when they started reading. You know, I'm very grateful to be working at a place that has that flexibility in terms of what they allow stylistically for the people who are reporting and writing for them to do.
Absolutely. I mean, I've been reading Slate for, I feel like 20 years, if not more. It's been around. It's one of the very first kind of web first journalism organizations that really has stood the test of time through multiple changes of ownership, even over that period.
Including Washington Post. So, you know, it used to be Graham Holdings used to, you know, had with the Washington Post. So, it's just a good fit for me. But that doesn't mean I couldn't work for a larger place. People can change careers at any point, and you know, I think it makes sense to be reporting from a community that you're familiar with. I don't think that necessarily mars my ability, or doesn't mar at all my ability to find stories and get really important you know, scoops and voices out there that wouldn't otherwise.
Do you think that that reflects a bit of a shift, a little bit of influence into what we consider in big air quotes mainstream journalism
over this last 20 years? Has indie media invaded the mainstream?
Is that in some little way? Yeah.
I don't know. I think a lot of people got their start in community media or indie media and are now mainstream journalists, and there's a sprinkling of us, but I don't think it's invaded is a word that I would even
or influenced, even just a little bit of influence because of editorial judgment, maybe moving with the times.
I think more than anything, I don't think that would be as correct to say as it would be say that the political situation that we're in, you know, it's very hard to be neutral when we're talking about, you know, migrant detention centers. You know, there's not like a both sides conversation to have when we're talking about the rise of neo-Nazism in the United
States. Some people try, April Glazer. I've seen it. Some people still try to have a view from nowhere about Nazis marching in the streets.
Sure. But people, I think, across, you know, the most mainstream of all media companies are unable to hold that anymore. And so I don't think that, you know, I think that comes from the particular moment we're in and things moving accordingly.
Well, April Glazer, I think we've gone on quite a journey. I thank you for joining us today.
Thanks,
you're a journalist
guys.
At Slate covering technology, and you wrote an article about Indie Media, Another Network is Possible, which people can read at Logic Magazine. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Survivor.
Yeah, it's always great to talk to LPFM folks, radio people, and folks that know about indie media. It's a joy. Thank you so much. Have a good one.
Yeah, I'm really grateful to April Glazer for writing that article that's in Logic Magazine. We'll have a link to it in our show notes at radiosurvivor.com/podcast. Because obviously it came at the same time that we were thinking about it. We've mentioned indie media several times over the course of this year.
It's not the TikTok of the history that I still want, but it's a really great article about why it's philosophically important, which is, I think, how we covered it today on Radio Survivor.
Yeah, the way she situates it and, you know, takes into account, you know, the trenchant problems we deal with today, the unintended consequences, if you will, of self-publishing, of people having unfettered access to platforms.
Oh, that's one thing, yeah.
That reach, millions of people.
I thought you were going to say the unintended consequences of having a media landscape that's dominated by major internet corporations,
right. You know,
which I don't know if those are unintended or not. That's why I laughed.
And I like that the framing is, right, another network is possible.
Yeah.
And I think that's always kind of what we want to leave people with here at Radio Survivor.
We still have the tools tomorrow to fix this.
Yeah, that we can talk about how things are messed up. We can talk about how the FCC feeds consolidation and the minimization of viewpoints. And we can talk about how different elements of corporate power work against communities. But I don't ever want us to become defeatist and to lose sight of the fact that there are communities that are making use of technologies like low power FM, podcasting, and other internet means to enhance the lives of the people who live there. And that we don't have to settle for breadcrumbs either. Like low power FM can be stronger than breadcrumbs, and maybe we can have high power FM too. I think that's really the perspective we try to come to it here at Radio Survivor.
Yeah, I agree. I'm glad we got that interview in the can. I hope the listeners liked it. You can listen to it again if you're tuning in on the radio. We are also a podcast at radiosurvivor.com. You can listen to us on that website, or you can subscribe anywhere where you get your podcasts, all the platforms.
Radio Survivor is supported by listeners and readers and is underwritten by Austin Airwaves, a legendary and mysterious organization supporting community radio projects around the world. 709. If you have any comments about the show, please drop us a line, podcast@radiosurvivor.com. As I mentioned just a little bit before, you can find lots and lots of show notes, links to learn more about the things we talked about on today's program. Go to radiosurvivor.com/podcast. And, you know, Radio Survivor is a podcast. It's a radio show. You might be listening to us on a radio station. But did you know that we are carried on more than 24 low power FM community and non-commercial stations around North America and around Ireland? As far away as Galway, Ireland, you can listen to the Radio Survivor show.
Paul, tell us about some of our new radio station affiliates.
Well, we really want to say a hearty welcome to the station for the San Francisco Public Press, which you heard about a few weeks ago here on Radio Survivor, KSFPLP 102.5 FM in the City by the Bay, San Francisco.
Not the first
California.
Time we talked about that station, but it won't be the last.
And we also welcome Cleveland State University's WCSB FM in Cleveland, Ohio, where Radio Survivor airs Mondays, 12 noon to 1 p.m. WCSB is a storied college radio station that's been very influential in underground and in indie music for decades and decades. And we're really, really excited that folks in Cleveland can hear Radio Survivor there.
Welcome to those listeners. Say hi, podcast@radiosurvivor.com.
And if you know about a college radio, community radio, low power FM, or other non-commercial station that you think would be a great place for Radio Survivor to air, you should let us know, or you should tell them, and you can learn more at our website, radiosurvivor.com.
Today I made the call. If you have an indie media story of your own to share with us, we'd love to hear from you. You can email us, tell us your story, and we would love to hear from you. podcast@radiosurvivor.com. Today we found one more data point that an indie media center, an IMC, was an important part of giving a real start to a low power FM radio station.
And I'm somehow
in a community.
Certain that there's a lot more of those out there.
Paul happens to know of now three, but we're going to guess that there's more than three. So if you can help us out with that research project, we'd love to hear from you. podcast@radiosurvivor.com.
You know, as a radio show, as community radio enthusiasts, you know that these platforms, like when I started the radio station with a group of people in Nashville, it was a nexus for our community as the community defined itself, right? And so all of these groups came together with the radio station that would have never probably worked together otherwise, or if they would, it would have taken a lot of work to bring us together and find our shared issues. But, you know, because we shared the radio station, the Cambodian community, the Somali community, the environmentalists, the, you know, interfaith leaders, the homeless advocates, we all were using the same radio station. Because of that, we were able to do so much solidarity work, and really we shared infrastructure, you know, we shared tools, and it really strengthens movements when you have common ground like that.